From WBUR Boston, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Lawmakers are heading home this week, back to their districts, where constituents are about to find out what the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is really all about. The GOP remains in full attack mode, with Republican Senator Ted Cruz rallying the grassroots behind the attempt to defund the program by threatening a government shutdown. Through the noise, the Obama administration and states are working 24/7 against tight deadlines to put the law in place. This hour on Point, Obamacare tries to clear the roadblocks. You can join us on air or online, where the conversation never ends. Where are we on Obamacare? Is the GOP taking the right approach? Going too far? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. A special welcome today to our new listeners on the WKSU stations covering northeastern Ohio and on WGLT in Bloomington Normal, Illinois, hometown of Tom Ashbrook. Joining me now from Washington is Chris Jennings, White House Coordinator for Health Reform Implementation. He served as senior health care advisor to President Clinton at the Domestic Policy and National Economic Councils from 1993 to 2001. Chris, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Chris, you spent a lot of time and energy in the Clinton administration trying to make this happen. Now, back in the White House, you are the proverbial dog that's caught the bus. And now that you see up close where we are just a few months from these exchanges going online, from the individual mandate kicking in, how does it look to you?
Well, you know, I'm really thrilled to be here. It's a privilege to be back. And by the way, I'm originally from Ohio, so I welcome your listeners from Ohio as well. I'm very confident, actually. I've seen extraordinary examples at both federal, state, and private sector of people collaborating together to prepare for the implementation. And I think we're going to have issues along the way. But what we're already seeing are some very, very significant success stories. And we've already seen benefits being put in place that Americans across the country are significantly valuing.
When you say issues along the way, what are the issues that concern you most as you see the different gears of this machine trying to kick in?
Well, I think you're mostly going to be seeing states collaborating very well with the federal government and the private sector. Where those states aren't committed to that end, you may see some variety where you'll see some states who are actually leaving substantial dollars on the plate here and not providing those dollars for their populations in need. We've seen that in such states like Texas. We've seen other states who haven't been all committed. But what we've been really excited about, John, is that even in those places, people on the ground are quite committed to getting the benefits that they will receive throughout the country. And preliminary indications are very, very good findings that we're seeing premiums being offered in significant places all across the country that are very, very affordable, a lot more choice, a lot more transparency, and a lot more accountability in a sector that we've had a lot of problems with over the years.
Chris, one of the things that I hear a lot from Republicans, from some in business, they look at things like the delay of the employer mandate. They look at things like the income verification, a delay in some of the steps that you were going to take, and say they point to part-time work and the possibility that employers are going to shift people from full-time to part-time to stay under the 50-employee threshold. Some say this is going to collapse of its own weight. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that they're wrong. We have had a healthcare system, remember, that did not serve the public well, did not serve employers well. I was a small business, and I know from year to year, we saw cycles, premiums going up and down all over the place, completely unpredictable. Some of those questions that you're raising aren't backed up by the facts. Of course, if you look at the part-time work, we've seen actual substantial increase in full-time employment. 9% of the job growth in the last year has been all for full-time work. Restaurant growth in jobs have significantly increased since the enactment of the Affordable Care Act. So there's a lot of smoke out there, but it's not real. And I think once people see and feel the benefits as they already are, we're going to be talking about having a debate about people saying, oh, the intervention you're talking about would actually take away things like prescription drugs or preventive or the elimination of the pre-existing condition exclusion, interactions that we've seen with the insurance industry in the past, which people are been so frustrated with. So I think in the end of the day, what we're hearing from the public at large is, come on, people, get together, work together. If there are things that need to be fixed, we can fix them. But let's not repeal or defund the law. No one is really saying that in any significant way. In fact, the Republican Party is divided on that very fact,
right,
as you've seen over the weekend.
One of the things that is real, though, is the political resistance, the political noise. Now, I'm wondering, what effect have you seen? How much of a problem is it for you that you've had the members of the Republican Party both not wanting to fund aspects of Obamacare, also discouraging some, the National Football League, for example, from participating in enrollment efforts? How much does that static affect what you're doing?
Well, obviously there are people who want to create all sorts of barriers for people and Americans to get the care that they deserve and are provided under the law. And that's unfortunate and regrettable. But, you know, I saw a little bit about this, John, in the Part D drug benefit. In this case, the Democrats opposed the enactment of that legislation early on. And then the benefits started to come into place. Constituents came to their members of Congress and said, can you help me access the benefits that I'm entitled to under the law? And suddenly Democrats decided, look, we have to do our jobs. We have to respond to our constituents' request. And over time, they did just that. And now we see a law in place that has been in place since 2003 and has been relatively successful. So, you know, we're going to have to go through those growing pains. It's a very polarized city in Washington. But sometimes I think we forget that this law is based on a bipartisan vision. Romney, Dole, Chafee, all the stakeholders strongly supported it, mostly because they knew that the healthcare system of old was completely unsustainable.
Chris, you do see the some political organizations encouraging people, doing a symbolic thing of burning their Obamacare draft card. There's an advertisement being run by a conservative group, Americans for Prosperity. I want you to listen to it and then react to its message.
If we can't pick our own doctor, how do I know my family is going to get the care they need? And what am I getting in exchange for higher premiums and a smaller paycheck? Can I really trust the folks in Washington with my family's health care? I think we all deserve some answers.
Okay, Chris, answer.
Well, the answer is it's an attack and negative rhetoric that doesn't reflect the law. We're going to provide more options, more choice, more affordability for all Americans. And for those people who have health care coverage through their employer-based system, we're seeing they're all retaining it. So it's a lot. And, of course, everyone has access to the plan of their choice, their doctor of their choice. But this is the typical rhetoric we've seen in every attempt to try to provide affordable, meaningful coverage for every American. And in this case, I think people are going to say, you know, isn't it time to come together, work together? Where there are issues, we can work on those issues. Absolutely. And that's
let me ask you about one of those issues in particular. Some people use the term rate shock, and you guys acknowledge that some people, especially younger, healthy males who are on the wrong end of some of the changes in insurance regulation are going to pay more. How big is that group and how much more are they going to pay?
Well, let's talk about rate shock, because what rate shock really would happen if we defunded the Affordable Care Act, what you'd see is that the tax credits that would go to those various populations would go away, and you'd have $1,000 to $8,000 premium increases for those populations. So that's the type of rate shock I don't think anyone wants to see. And those various tax credits will provide a lot more affordability for those young populations that you're talking about. So I guess, you know, where there's some variation in some states where you'll see some of those premiums be in different places for those populations. They will also have access to tax credits to make it more affordable.
To what degree?
And, of course, if they were repealed or defunded the law, you would see those rates increase substantially. So that's just the wrong way to go. It's the wrong prescription. And really what we need to do is get everyone in the system so we can make sure, and this is the most important point, if people really want to have protections against those pre-existing condition exclusions that have discriminated against population on populations, one out of two Americans have pre-existing conditions in this country. And if we want to get rid of that, we need to get everyone in the healthcare system. And that's what we're doing by providing more affordability, more choices, more competition, more transparency.
Chris,
and that's what the law is going to do.
Is the insurance industry your ally or your adversary in the implementation right now?
You know, that's a great question. For the most part, the health industry as a whole, physicians, nurses, doctors, and health plans have been allies, working with consumer and labor and many in the business community, mostly because they know that in the past, insurers, and remember, the insurance industry competed on their ability to avoid sick populations, not to better provide better care. And they were almost forced to do that in the marketplace in which their competitors, their bad apple competitors, discriminated against sick population.
Chris,
if you get everyone in the healthcare system, that no longer will be the case.
Chris, we're out of time. I want to thank you for joining us this morning. It's been a big help. We're discussing the challenges ahead for Obamacare. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at the fight over Obamacare. Joining me now from Washington is Julie Rovner, health policy correspondent for NPR, who specializes in the politics of healthcare. She's also the author of Healthcare Policy and Politics, A to Z. Julie Rovner, welcome back to On Point.
Nice to be here.
And with us from Sea Island, Georgia, is Gail Walensky, an economist and senior fellow at Project Hope, an international health education foundation. She was administrator of the Healthcare Financing Administration, directing Medicare and Medicaid under President George H.W. Bush. She advised John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign and contributed to the McCain health plan. She's also on the board of directors of Geisinger Health Systems, one of the top national delivery systems nationwide. Gail Walensky, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, John.
Gail, let me start with you. You and I had a conversation a few weeks ago when I was doing a story for the New York Times about healthcare, and you said 2013 and 14 are going to be bumpy years. What do you mean by that?
The states differ in how ready they are to expand coverage either through Medicaid or through the exchanges. Some states have been working on getting their exchanges up and running since the law was passed in 2010. Maryland, near where I live, is one of them. Many other states either are relying on the federal government, the majority of those, to have the exchanges ready. Some, like the District of Columbia, where I live, is doing its own, but not nearly as ready as, say, Maryland. That's what I mean by a bumpy year. There will be bumps along the way as people try to get new coverage, but the country has had other bumpy periods that isn't necessarily a deal breaker.
Julie, from where you sit and you look at the number of states that are not setting up their own exchanges, the federal government's having to come in and do that, what is the biggest danger for, let's say you're in a state that's not setting up their own exchange? Is it that the software won't work? Is it that you won't have the insurance options that other states have? What are the problems that arise when a state says, no, I don't want to play?
Yeah, I think the biggest concern, certainly the administration's biggest concern, is that what you were saying first, is that when they press the button on October 1st, that big computer system that they're building isn't going to work. The federal government really had no idea that this many states were going to default, as it were, to the federal government. And, you know, remember that this is mostly the law that we're looking at is mostly the law that was written by the Senate. The Senate really wanted to defer to the states, and they envisioned the idea of there being 50 different state exchanges. They thought this would appeal to Republicans, frankly, that Republicans would want to say, okay, we can build this our own way.
Party, you know, of federalism.
Exactly. You know, Massachusetts did it. Massachusetts way. There was already an exchange in Utah, and, you know, that Utah was doing it their way. And that's right, that there would be, you know, let 1,000 flowers bloom, or in this case, 50 flowers bloom. And that's not what happened. Most of the states that are doing it themselves are run by Democrats, frankly. There are very few Republican-run exchanges. And so basically what we're having is essentially 30 states that the federal government is having to basically, you know, do mostly itself. Then there came the problem of there just wasn't enough money for the federal government to do it. They went back to Congress and said, can we have some more money? And Congress, which of course, you know, House being run by Republicans, wants to choke off this law any way it can, said, we're not going to give you any more money. In fact, we're going to try to take back some of the money we've given you. So the federal government has had limited money to do more than it expected it would have to do on very tight timelines. Remember, there was this question about whether the law was even going to go forward until the Supreme Court ruled last year. So a lot of things are basically late. So I think that's the biggest concern when they press the button, is this all going to work? And that's really what we're looking at. Then, as you mentioned, there's going to be different numbers of plans in different states, and sometimes in different parts of different states. Remember, this is voluntary for the insurance companies. Do they want to play? As Chris mentioned, one of the big changes here is that insurance companies are no longer going to be able to discriminate based on whether people have pre-existing conditions. Some insurance companies are very concerned that only sick people are going to sign up. That's why there's been this big push we've seen to get healthy young people to sign up. They want to make sure that there's a balance of risk in these insurance plans. So some insurers have said that they're going to hold back and not put out plans for a while. We've seen in states like Mississippi, there may be a very limited number of plans available. In some other states, in California, it turns out there's going to be a whole lot of plants. In New York, a whole lot of plants. So it's going to be different in different parts of the country. So as Gail said, that it's going to be perhaps a bumpy year or two as you know, this all sort of plays itself out, and we see what's out there and how it's going to settle itself.
Gail, on Julie's question, knowing government as you do and knowing this industry as you do, do you think that when people around the country go on the exchanges in October and hit the button, that the information technology will work and they'll be able to make choices, or do you expect a crash?
I think it will depend where they are. The Government Accounting Office recently released a report saying that the computer systems that the federal government is relying on for the 30-plus states that will be have federal exchanges is running behind schedule, and it may not be ready on time, and that the training for people who are supposed to help individuals get insurance, called navigators, that training has been delayed. In the state of Maryland, they have had their exchange up since a year ago, August. The people in Maryland shouldn't have any difficulty. This is surprising. Maryland has been very supportive of the Affordable Care Act, and as soon as the law was passed, they started making plans for this expansion.
I believe they have a governor who wants to run for president in the Democratic Party.
That does help make the activity go smoother and faster, no question about that. So I think in many states, like Virginia, Mississippi, Missouri, these are all states that are relying on the federal exchanges. It's questionable whether they will work. In places like the District of Columbia, which is trying to run its own, they have not to date put anything up to see how it works. So whether that will actually happen as it's planned is also questionable. People need to expect that there will be these problems. How serious they are is really what's hard to tell. And we will know very soon because October 1st is coming up very quickly. Again, we've had bumpy starts, but we haven't really experienced anything as large as this expansion in any time I can remember during my adult lifetime. I was too young or still involved in other activities when Medicare first started to think about what happened in those early days.
Elementary school activities.
Yeah, people, not quite, but still not paying any attention. People have talked about how does this compare with the expansion of the prescription drug coverage under Medicare? Well, the answer is this is way bigger. It's a much more innovative activity. And many of the people who are involved in getting insurance have not had previous involvement either with the tax system sometimes or with insurance coverage. So many of the activities that they're about to start engaging in are new activities for them. That wasn't the case for Part D. These people were all known under Medicare. There was a relationship already with Medicare. So it's actually not a very good analogy. It's why I expect 2013 and possibly 2014 to be bumpy. But that doesn't mean we can't get through them. We just need to understand what's likely to
be
patience. In front of us. Yeah.
Let's go to our callers. We've got Carol calling from Stillwater, Oklahoma. Carol, you're on Point.
Hi, John. I work in the insurance industry. I'm an agent. And she is correct. It's going to be a mess when all of this is implemented, if it is implemented. But my question is, Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security are all running out of money. So how is the government going to fund this insurance coverage that they're offering? And I guess my point would be that it would be wonderful if everybody could have insurance, and they should. But sometimes everybody should have something that's not feasible for whatever reason for everybody to have it. Insurance rates are going to go up, we're being told, 30% for groups, and they don't even know how much they're going to go up for individuals. So I don't see how it's going to be funded, and I don't know how people are going to be able to afford it. And also, what are they going to do if someone opts out of it and they're going to be penalized? How are they going to collect that penalty?
Carol, thanks for your call. Let me put that question to Julie Robner, who's been covering these issues. Carol, Julie, how are they going to pay for it?
Well, the bill, quite controversially, was fully funded. It doesn't add to the deficit. Some of the money was taken out of future payments to Medicare, mostly payments to hospitals and Medicare private plans. The private plans were, of course, given extra money in the Medicare prescription drug law that we've been talking about. So some of that money was taken back. That money was given to try and encourage more people to go into those private health plans. The hospitals basically agreed to give some of the money back on the theory that if there were more people covered with health insurance, they wouldn't have to give up so much charity care. So basically, they considered it kind of a wash. They were getting extra money from Medicare to take care of people who were uninsured. So the idea was now these people will be insured, so they won't have to give so much free care. So that was the sort of the bulk of the Medicare payments.
Let me ask Gail a question about premiums. Gail, how do you sort out yourself from changes in health premiums that are going to be the result of Obamacare and the changes in health premiums that we've seen throughout our lifetimes that happen all the time because healthcare costs go up?
Well, the best way to look at it is to look at states that have different, very different rates of coverage now and to see how they differ in terms of health spending increases and premium increases. One of the big questions is going to be how many of the young healthy actually show up. To the extent they come in, that'll help mitigate the increase that are caused by having known predictably high users of healthcare be able to get insurance at rates that can't very much because of their high expected use. Chris Jennings and other people associated with the administration have always talked about this as the way to try to balance that increase. There's a lot of question about whether they will actually show up, and even more question about the ability of the government to sort out who has insurance and who doesn't, to provide penalties, to collect those penalties, to see whether the subsidies that people receive are actually the appropriate subsidies given their income. But we do have some states where coverage has been quite substantial in the past, and trying to look at what happens to increases in insurance premiums and increases in health spending across these different states will help give some insights as to how much is reflecting the expanded coverage and particularly the potential adverse selection. That means getting the sickest in more quickly than the healthy into these insurance pools, and how much is reflecting just general increase in spending, which mercifully
is slowing down right now.
Has been unusually slow. We don't exactly know why that is or how long it will last, but it is very fortunate.
We'll take the good news. Let's go to one other caller. We've got Larry from Indianapolis. Larry, welcome to On Point. What's your question?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, my question is that why is it that the Republicans want to give in on this fanatical pressure to try to stop Obamacare? It's like all the people I've met, I drive a truck around the country, all the people I've met around the country, some are for it, some are against it. The ones against it seem to have amnesia when it comes to how things were before Obamacare. And instead of insurance companies, health insurance industry, price gouging and ripping off the American people and not giving them anything, having their own death squad stopping people from getting care, this program is going to help the American people.
Let me put that question to Gail Walensky. Gail, you're a Republican. How do you grade the way your party has handled this law after it passed?
Well, I thought that's really two phases. The first is what happened going up to the 2012 election and the Supreme Court ruling. Republicans who didn't like the Affordable Care Act were entitled both to hope that the legal challenge would change it and to hope the results of the 2012 election would elect a president and a Congress that would change it. I've personally been rather frustrated that Republicans have had many years to try to do it a better way and let those opportunities go by. As was mentioned in my introduction, I was involved in trying to help Senator McCain flesh out his health care proposal, which was a different strategy to getting health care coverage. I'm frustrated and have said this publicly that since the election of 2012, when people have spoken, many Republicans have acted as though the people didn't speak. The fact is that Democrats were elected to control the Senate. President Obama was returned to the White House. And we have the Affordable Care Act as the law of the land. I think it's time to recognize we can do many things to improve this law, but we need to think about how to follow the law of the land and improve it.
Why do you think Republicans have in Washington have not accepted the verdict of the 2012 election, as you just indicated?
I guess those that feel strongly are hoping that there will be ways to undo it. I think they're not going to be successful and ought to focus on other things. But people don't always like to face unpleasant realities. This seems to be one of them.
Julie, do you think, you know, we've just had the 40th House Republican vote to repeal Obamacare. Is this something that is fated to go nowhere or fated to go nowhere, at least until we have another presidential election?
Well, they certainly seem to want to keep it going, you know, I think they think if they can keep the issue, you know, front and center, that they can, you know, perhaps take the Senate back in 2014 and then force something. It's hard to know. I think right now they're afraid that if 2014 comes and this thing gets entrenched, there'll be no chance to ever, you know, get it, you know, unseated. I think that's the concern right now.
Gail Walensky, senior fellow at Project Hope, thanks so much for joining us. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. we're talking about the rocky road ahead for Obamacare. As states rush to implement the program and Republicans go full force to take it down. With us this hour is Julie Robner, health policy correspondent for NPR. And joining us now from Holland, Michigan, is Kevin Counihan, chief executive officer for Access Health Connecticut, the agency created to implement the Federal Affordable Care Act in the state. Kevin Counihan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Kevin, I read an article recently about your attempts to get this going in Connecticut. You said, I wish we had another year. You don't have another year. What's it going to look like on October 1st?
October 1st, we're going to have an active exchange. We're going to offer a broad choice of competitively priced plans in the three metal tiers. We're going to have a active marketing and outreach campaign in place, which is going to include retail stores. We're the first state, or I think the only state, that's actually going to be offering actual retail insurance stores in our state. And we believe that we're going to be offering a good consumer experience.
And what problems do you foresee? What keeps you up at night when you think about, as Julie Robner said in our previous hour, what happens when consumers in Connecticut hit that button? What concerns you about what they're going to find?
Well, there are three major challenges that I see in implementation, irrespective of state. One is operational. The second is outreach and marketing, and the third is political. The operational piece, frankly, we're feeling pretty good about. I say pretty good because in a lot of ways, actual testing, true end-to-end testing, actually doesn't begin until October 1st. And because we're using, all the states are basically using not real data. So we're going to be using real data effective with the launch on October 1. We're also trying to limit as many functionalities and pings to the federal hub that we can in order just to make sure that we're controlling as much of our own destiny in Connecticut.
Simplify
as possible. Yeah, exactly. That's one that I think keeps us all up a little bit at night. But, you know, to be frank, John, I think this is a three-year implementation, and I think that, you know, a lot like Medicare Part D took 3 to 4 years before that stabilized. I think the same thing is true here.
I want to play for you an advertisement that Organizing for Action, a pro-Obamacare outfit, is airing, and get you to react to it.
Handing her over for surgery is the hardest thing I've ever had to do. Before Obamacare, insurance companies could put lifetime caps on your health insurance. Once you hit that cap, they don't pay anymore. Zoe was halfway to her cap before her first birthday.
Obamacare ended lifetime caps.
Thanks to Obamacare, we can now afford the care that Zoe needs. And for her, that's a lifesaver.
Now, Kevin, you are working and trying to get this up and running in one of the home places for the American insurance industry. How true to life is the picture in that ad, and how are insurance companies reacting to it and helping you or not helping you?
Well, I think that type of ad is very effective with respect to appealing to some of the emotional components around health insurance and fears that average citizens have around pre-existing conditions, being denied coverage for medical underwriting, and things of that sort. Our travels throughout Connecticut has certainly validated that. Irrespective of location and irrespective of income level or population segment, people are all afraid that certain things like that could happen to them. So these types of provisions just outlined in that ad are actually popular irrespective of party or ideology. Our experience with the insurance industry in Connecticut has been very positive. We've done a lot to reach out to these folks early on to help them work with us operationally, how to format data, work on marketing. So I feel that we've been fortunate.
Julie, let me bring you in, because when I read the Kevin saying, you know, I wish we had another year, and he's now saying it's a three-year implementation process. That's in a state that is aggressively trying to do this, that is sympathetic, a blue state that's trying to do this. When you get into a state with a Republican governor that isn't setting up their own exchange, how do you think that the experience of consumers there is going to differ from people who plug into Kevin's system?
You know, one thing that's really important to remember and that I think I can't stress enough is that we're all focusing on sort of the implementation of these exchanges, but it's really a very, you know, small part of the law in that it's going to affect really a remarkably small number of people. They're only expecting about 7 million people to join the exchanges in the first year, and ultimately only about, you know, I think it's 24 million people. The majority of people, this is one of the dirty little secrets of the Affordable Care Act, the majority of the uninsured who were going to get covered under the law were going to be part of this Medicaid expansion, which of course is now only happening right now in about half the states. That the exchanges were important, but they were the really some of the bigger parts of the law had to do with the things that have already gone into effect. That ad that you just played about no more lifetime limits, that has nothing to do with the exchanges. That has to do with people who have private employer-provided insurance. Those were things that have already happened, that happened back in 2010 when the law first went into effect. So the exchanges, yes, we're all looking at it, we're all focusing on it, but it's really the exchanges are just for people who buy their own insurance or who are uninsured now and don't have access to employer insurance. So
but
it's
Julie,
really a
isn't
small
that where,
subset.
But isn't that where people are going to see Obamacare,
yes,
see the pricing,
absolutely,
see the interaction, and
absolutely. I'm not downplaying the significance of what it looks like. I just want to stress that this is not the entirety of the law. It is definitely what people are looking at, and you're absolutely right. In states where, you know, in sort of the redder states, in the states that, or even in some of the blue states where the federal government is in charge, there is a concern, as Kevin was saying, even if everything works with the software, there is a concern about there will be less outreach, definitely, in those states. That's where some of these outside groups are trying to play a role, Organizing for America, Enroll America, and indeed some of the anti-Obamacare groups are coming in and trying to get people not to sign up. But in the Texases and the Floridas of the world, where you have lots and lots of uninsured people who could sign up for insurance on the exchanges, that's where we're going to see, you know, what's really, you know, that's where the rubber meets the road, whether who's going to come and sign up? Is it just going to be sick people who need insurance? Or are we going to get some of these healthy young people to balance off these risks?
All right, let's go to callers. We've got Beth from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Beth, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Hi, John. I'm wondering if here in Wisconsin, we've got several counties that are trying to circumvent our governor's blockade of the Medicare expansion dollars, and so they're trying to go at it on their own to access those dollars. And can any of your guests tell me how successful they may or may not be in accessing those dollars as they go around the governor's, for lack of a better word, you know, blocking of those dollars?
Julie, you want to take a crack at Beth's question?
Yeah, this is. I know that this is the Medicaid expansion, and I know there are some efforts. I'm pretty sure that the state I know there have been a couple of states where the governor has actually sought to expand Medicaid and been turned down by the state legislature. Florida and Ohio are two of the more significant, you know, the gotten a lot of press about this. In Arizona, Governor Jan Brewer wanted to expand Medicaid. The legislature said no, and she basically refused to sign any more legislation until the legislature consented to do it, which they eventually did. So you definitely have some fights going on. I don't know whether individual counties or individual subsections of states can actually pull down that money. I believe that it has to be I think it's either state in or state out. But I do know in Illinois that there was I believe the city of Chicago was able to pull down to join early. So there are some options. I'm just not totally familiar with what they are.
Right. Let's go to Aaron from Omaha, Nebraska. Aaron, go ahead.
Hi, John. This is a great program, but listening to one of your first caller's questions, I think demonstrated some of the information bias that people bring when they're talking about Obamacare. She was saying, we're being told that this is going to cost a lot more to get individual coverage in the state of, I believe she was in Oklahoma. However, I think if she's been paying attention, like so many people have, to the news that's coming out, you would see, you know, New York, California, today, you know, your guest was even mentioning Connecticut, where there are likely to be lower individual costs in those markets So the information is out there, but I believe some people don't want to listen to it.
Well, let's get Kevin to talk about specifically some of that information. Kevin, in Connecticut, what is going to happen to rates as you prepare to offer a menu of plans to your constituents?
Well, the caller's question is a terrific one, by the way. And I think, you know, in our experience, both in Connecticut and, frankly, nationally, there's an ideological predisposition to this legislation almost before either one knows what it's about. So there are people against it that really don't know much about it, and there are people in favor of it really don't know much about it. So I think that it's really incumbent upon everyone to get access to information. And to your point and to your caller's point, we're working aggressively to do exactly that, and we're doing it in a number of different ways. So one of which is a show like this, which we do throughout the state. The second is with traditional media. The third is with social or digital media. The fourth is through special outreach that we have of concerts, promotions that we have on the summer beaches at the Connecticut shore, and, as I said, in opening up these retail insurance stores. So all of this needs to be done on the grassroots level. It has to be done consistently. And frankly, it's part of the challenge and also part of the fun.
Kevin, if I am buying health care now on the individual market in Connecticut, and I then go on the exchanges in October, am I going to see my rates go up or down?
Well, this is going to be an answer you're not going to like, because it depends. And it's one of the challenges. Everybody would like to know, well, my rate's either going up, down, you know, 8%, or it's going down 12%. It's actually going to very much depend on some variables. It's going to depend on your age. It's going to depend on the plan you buy. It's going to depend on the zip code of where you're located. It's going to depend on the insurance company that you go with. But in general, from the basis of what we've seen from filed rates so far, we think that most people, the vast majority, are going to find competitive rates. They're going to find a lot of options. And I think they're going to be in for some good news.
Is it likely to be up for young, healthy men, down for, let's say, middle-aged women?
It's remember, there's not a gender distinction. Our state was actually one that had a tremendous load on women that's now being removed as part of the Affordable Care
Act.
That's
my point. There has been a gender distinction, which is now being eliminated.
That is exactly correct. So I would say, in general, what you said is right, that for younger people, because of the age rate compression change, that rates would be going up. But the vast, vast majority of young people, as you know, will be eligible for subsidies, which are quite significant. And then for folks at the older end of the age spectrum, which includes myself, we would actually see rates fall. So I think we're going to see a wide variety of different options for people. I think the prices are going to be competitive. And frankly, what consumers care about is not so much the retail cost. They care what it costs to them, what the net cost is to them after the subsidy.
Let's take another call. We've got John from Milan, Illinois. John? Welcome to On Point.
Hello, John. Oh, hello, John. Thank you for taking my call. My concern in the healthcare is some of the revenue propositions of it. I read in the revenue section there was to be an excise tax on medical devices, which can be anything from a heart pacemaker to tongue depressors. And I see that in Congress now, Senators Kochabar and Franken are trying to sponsor a bill to either eliminate or reduce those revenues substantially. And also the other section was on what they call, quote, Cadillac plans. There was going to be a 48% excise tax. And I see now many of those big firms that have those Cadillac plans can continue them as far as 2019. I wonder what's going to replace that revenue.
Thank you, John, for that call. Julie, are any of the attempts to strip away unpopular pay-for mechanisms going to succeed?
Well, they haven't yet, but that's not to say that they're not there. And yeah, when we were talking about how this is paid for, there are a number of taxes on the health industry. There's actually a tax on health insurance plans themselves that starts next year. There is this the tax on medical devices, and there is this very controversial tax on what's called Cadillac health plans. That doesn't go into effect for another couple of years. But yes, people with very generous coverage will start paying a tax. The theory is that most people won't end up paying the tax because the coverage would then be scaled back. There's a lot of doubt about whether that's ever going to happen, that that might be either changed or altered or repealed.
Although that's supposed to be one of the features of the law with the greatest long-term effect on curbing costs.
Indeed it is, as you say. But, you know, right now, what I was going to say is that Congress has not had a lot of luck or impact or ability to change anything about this law. You know, one of the things, one of the you know, with Republicans so dug in against it, they have not allowed, you know, Gail was saying earlier that there, and so is Chris, both were saying that there are things that, that definitely could be changed, could be fixed. A law of this magnitude normally by this time would have had a couple of rounds of what are known as technical corrections.
If
there's
they could
a lot
agree.
Of glitches. If they could agree. But Republicans, of course, are so dug in against it that they basically say, Democrats, you know, you dug this hole, you know, you're going to live in it.
Right.
And so there's been no ability to fix any of the glitches or even any, you know, there have been very few. There have been maybe five or six small things
right.
that have been altered in this law. But
Julie,
many,
I wanna,
many things that they definitely would like to fix and haven't been able to.
I want to read one Facebook reaction to Kevin and get him to respond. Aaron DeCurtis posted a message saying, I wish the media and politicians would listen to those of us in Massachusetts for whom this has worked very well. Kevin, what lessons have you in Connecticut drawn from the Massachusetts experience?
I think one is patience. I think that that's one of the things that I'm most concerned about is we live in a world of instant gratification, and we're going to be concerned that this law is going to be evaluated on enrollment in October. There's not going to be much enrollment in October. Most people are going to be kicking the tires in October. They're going to be testing the system. They're going to be comparing rates. They're going to be looking to see if they're eligible for subsidies. Enrollment is largely going to start at the end of November and into the first couple of weeks of December. That's when people are going to write checks for January 1. So I think patience is one. I think the importance of communication and outreach is a second. I think the third is to engage and understand that this is about shared responsibility.
Kevin Counihan, Chief Executive Officer for Access Health Connecticut, thank you so much. Julie Robner, Health Policy Correspondent for NPR, thank you too. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, we talk with Senator Rand Paul and others on libertarianism and the future of the Republican Party. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.